conference in America, the open engagement conference with social practice, yeah. Art and social practice. They split it. You've got art and social practice. And I think that's quite interesting as well. So I seem to have developed a hybrid. It's art as a social practice as opposed to a social process, which at the moment, and this is the last 2 days, I'm feeling quite happy with that. So art as a social practice, I think it's quite cool. No.
I think it's interesting that they split it, because that's my issue, is that, you know, like it doesn't go to the heart of what Eucalys was saying about creativity if you split it. Because I also see that Lacey does it, because she says in interviews, she says some of it is art and some of it is organizing.
Yeah.
And then, like, yeah. To me, that's more conservative than saying organizing is also art.
Yeah. Which is what APG, of course, said, and we found a language for completely. Yeah. So I think there are some hidden gems in APG, actually.
Art as a social practice, or
art as a social practice. What do you think? So it hasn't split it.
Yeah.
But it's descriptive. And it moves the relational. Drops the relational.
Hi. Where can I drop this?
Who's it for?
I'm not sure how you say that.
Yeah, she's just. I'll take it.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
No worries. Cheers. It's an interview. Well, I thought it was an interview. It's actually co-authoring a paper.
Well, there was denial on your part.
There was denial on my part.
Until this point. Confusion. But that's what we were doing.
Yeah, that's what was going on.
Right.
Well,
there's really anywhere else to go, then, isn't
there? Will it interrupt you? I don't know. Will it make it more difficult for you?
No, it's okay. The point is, okay, so
yeah,
the first point in the abstract is that we have a methodology, which I was trying to work out at the end from our first paper. So I put using a conversational methodology.
Yeah.
So I suppose, you know, it's just what we do, but we don't normally record it. So
hopefully
that, if I don't keep reminding you that we're recording it. And I suppose then part of the paper will be writing about this, which is where the other one came in, and I looked over our paper.
Yeah.
And put these notes about it not being separate from life, so it's fine that we interrupt it and everything.
Sure.
And that meaning is generated in the social moments, and that in some ways I look at the, you know, my impulse, well, we both talked about it, was the historical roots of this through Paolo Freire and a bit in the consciousness raising as well, but. So this kind of idea of relational understanding. These are just my notes from our methodology.
Yeah.
And to value our own specific experiences. So then I feel that this paper is important to try and talk about both the contexts. But of course it is an interview as well, so you'll be mainly talking about yours, but in when I write the paper.
Okay.
And I will talk a little bit about South Seas as well. So
yeah, okay.
To get that exchange thing, so it's not like a one. So if we're talking about learning and pedagogy, then it's not just one way.
Okay, that's
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the kind of what you're thinking of with the abstract, that still sort of stands. That hasn't shifted,
that's just
really.
That's just me unpacking that small.
Yeah.
Using a conversational methodology bit of the abstract.
Yeah, but the link through.
Yeah.
Lavender to South Seats. That's still kind of what you're.
Yeah, thinking. All I did was look at the abstract and then try to write the questions from the abstract.
Yeah, okay.
So I didn't think.
I didn't know whether that had changed with changes at South Seeds or doesn't need to because of the pain.
No.
That's cool then.
Good. I don't think so. It's like a, I think it's a problem. Well, it's an issue still, so.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's that. Then you already, so I suppose I wanted to start, we could start by you talking about your research question, or if you want to.
Yeah.
Because you already started talking about it as a social practice, or what that social value added by the artists.
Well, I suppose since we wrote that previous paper, which was nearly a year ago now, wasn't it? Amazingly, for June. I've kind of zoned in on from taking the Lavender project to a kind of a more reflective phase after that, sort of around September, and coming out of that thinking more about the actual kind of nature of sociability or qualities of sociability in art as a social practice. So in order to kind of really, if we say that meaning is generated within social moments, I guess what you could say is that I'm looking at the qualities of sociability.
Mm-hmm.
In relation to that, or as that. It's quite specific, isn't it? And it's taken quite a while to kind of find a definition about that, but you're going to be delighted to hear that it totally fits in with your with our conversational methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Because what has gone down quite well with what I've been doing is that I've gone to Deserto and the practice of every day. And I don't know if you've read it.
No.
Well, in it, he defines, he references Foucault, who you do know.
Mm-hmm.
But he talks about the act of speaking. And he comes up with four characteristics in relation to a linguist from the 1960s, whose name I can't remember. And I've taken those four characteristics, which I'll try and remember and tell you in a minute, as a way to then discuss the qualities of sociability. And the reason that I've done that is that he talks about the difference between reading a sentence and speaking a sentence.
Yeah.
As one of the kind of, to phrase Foucault, a minuscule, I love this word, minuscule, a tiny act of the everyday, a really ordinary moment that is contains, and it's interesting to remember Ferrer again, if that's how you say it, because it's about liberation, it's about choosing to enunciate, and I think that word enunciate is really important, choosing to, as the individual, become social. And activate the text. So you could decide to do that on your own in a place where nobody hears you. So Andy and I at home, we've been having these conversations in the kitchen where I've been saying, does it change if I read a sentence? Does the meaning change if I read it out loud? And does it change differently if you're in the room when I read it to when you're in the room to read it? So it's taken us in some really interesting places, I think. And then, so that's why I think this, it's got mileage in terms of sociability, because what Deserto then does is he uses the structure of the sentence or the construction of a sentence as a metaphor for the infrastructures of society. Okay. And so then, as a person, it's brilliant, isn't it? So then, as somebody deciding to speak that sentence, you're intervening. Yeah. You're taking hold of it and owning it and interacting.
So that's where Foucault comes in, because we're all responsible for the power structures.
Tell me about that then. Why do you think that?
It was what I was thinking about after I heard a presentation at the conference that Alana did, Alana Jelenek I've worked with, and she kind of contrasts Marxism to Foucault, to being Foucauldian, because she says that she describes the structures of the art world, and then she kind of like really emphasizes that we are all responsible for making them all the time. So, you know, they don't exist before us, you know, in the way that Marx would say that there's a base structure that we
It is the way it is because of what we do.
We all do it all the time in our everyday actions. So,
yeah, okay.
So I suppose then that fits in with this choosing to enunciate a sentence which is a metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. Being, it's a liberating act, I think, as well, in terms of prayer, because you're then setting up the possibility of enormous amounts of interactions and consequences from that decision.
Mm.
So it's really interesting, I think, to think about what makes, why does somebody choose to do it? Why do we do it? So if you then kind of think about sociability in relation to the act of speaking, these four characteristics, if I can remember them, I might not be able to remember them, I might need to get my laptop. I haven't got the book here. They are tiny actions of the everyday. That's one of them. They are part of a larger paradigm. So, for instance, the act of speaking is part of linguistics. So it's part of a domain or a field. That's the second one. The third one is... just concentrate. I've got another notebook. Third one. Anyway, I won't worry about that now.
Yeah.
But anyway, there are these four characteristics.
Mm.
So what I'm doing now is that I've kind of found this definition. I'm discussing the artist, so my methodology is going through that basically. So I think that that might be something that's quite interesting in where I've kind of moved to.
Yeah, I did a really...
Yeah.
After the mother tongue dart, I did an experiment. Well, it didn't actually... In fact, in itself that it didn't work out is interesting. But, I had had a conversation with Tiffany and Jessica over emails that was just sort of between us saying that, and I had asked them questions and things. So it was kind of semi-formal, semi-informal. And then I recorded the conversation, you know, the way they described in our DART, the way they kind of described their project. And so I transcribed it, and then I did the same format that I had with our text, where I had their voices, with the added confusion that they had two voices, and my voice, you know, my speech that I did for the DART, and their talk that they did. And their talk was like a lot more, mine was much more formal, you know, I'd read out my thing than theirs. And also added to this, they both had their thought processes that kind of paired in.
Mm.
And it made a really interesting transcript. Like, between, there were hardly any finished sentences. And yet somehow the meaning had been, I think, a lot clearer. The meaning of their piece was much clearer than mine in the spoken room. That was the idea I got. But when you wrote it down, there was nothing finished. they just said, you know, they sort of started sentences and then they had other thoughts that got chucked in the middle of them, and it was really hard to put the grammar in place, and the whole thing was I thought it was a really interesting experiment, and then I wanted to send it somewhere, but they were really reluctant because they say we have to, because we're doing something quite controversial, we have to like really tightly edit our texts, and so there was also this gap between what they would put out as a written text, what they were comfortable putting out, and how they had spoken in the room. So,
but you sent it to them and they read it?
Yeah. They said that it would take too much time to... Like, basically, I had a deadline for what I wanted to send it to, and they said that they have to be really careful because they've been under attack for this project, and that it needed so much work to make it an actual text. Which I thought was interesting, because then where was the work, or like what is the vulnerability of the text and that isn't in the spoken word, and you know, because it's not about bringing across meaning exactly, or what gets lost. Or I had all of those questions, so I think that's a little bit of an aside, but I found it interesting to talk about this because of that.
And I think that's interesting because it made me think about the difference between text and visual culture, which is how I'm talking about sociability, or the context that I'm talking about it in relation to, rather than literature. So obviously it's a kind of definition or analogy that works to a certain extent, but not completely. So, but it's useful because of the differences that it's made me think about between the two. And that language is inevitably absolutely necessary to being able to discuss or be critical about whether something's art or not, for instance. So it's really focused my mind on that, actually, and how, and then with what I'm doing for the Open Engagement Conference, just to kind of continue, and thank you for your contribution, by the way.
Right?
Yeah, it's brilliant. I realised that actually what sociability is ultimately about is people finding their own language to be able to know for themselves why something is art or not, and what the value of that is to them. And I think that the process, you know, art as a social practice in a sense, is absolutely about that. Because that, you know, when we were talking about valuing ourselves, value our own experiences, I think the purpose of art as a social practice is to create experiences where the participants and yourself value your own experiences in new ways, really. But you have to have the language, in a sense, to do that, don't you? Or do you? Can you just know it? Have you got to be able to? No, of course you haven't got to be able to say it. I think from the practice, the point of view of, as Lacey would call it, new genre public art, whatever, we need that language of the participants. Actually, as researchers, this community, I think, whether they need that language or not is another question.
Which is a lot kind of more, I mean, yeah.
See what I mean?
We need it. Do they need it? Okay.
So today, this morning, I've taken a couple of the responses from participants stage further than I've taken them with you and John, for instance, because I've asked them, and neither of them have answered yet, but I've also asked them if it's possible to answer, if they found the language to talk about art in relation to the Lavender Project because of that experience, or if they thought these things already. So I'm kind of asking them what they think about that now. Which wasn't a question I had in mind at all at the start of the process. but it's mm. sort of quite naturally where it's gone to, where it's travelled to.
Okay,
sorry, that's probably a bit rambly.
No. Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I'm going to go through the abstract, I guess. That's how I've written the questions.
Yeah.
Like I've just looked at it.
Go on then.
So, I use the term cultural mapping, because that's the framework of the conference.
Yeah.
Drawing out the strategy examines artistic processes to cultural mapping, drawing out strategies that are useful in forging complex community identities. So first of all, and then later on, what did I say, community, yeah, at the end of the paragraph, I also say building community-driven spaces. Yeah, so I guess I want to look at that term, community-driven spaces, and then maybe...
As cultural mapping?
Sorry. Yeah. What have I said about
this point seems to be about the crossover between community knowledge and academia.
Yeah, have I done it wrong? I think there are actually two things here. There's... the question of cultural mapping, which I actually come to later, so I'm not going.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, so we'll where just do like building community driven spaces.
Okay.
I'd probably put that first so that we could get a little bit of background about Wood and Barn,
yeah.
And whether you think it's community driven, what you think about this term community driven space,
okay,
and whether it is one or.
What. Does that come from the conference?
No, that's just from.
Is that your own?
Yeah.
Good work. Okay. Community-driven spaces. Well, I'm not that keen on car metaphors.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right. Beginning.
Start it off. mind you, they do all mostly drive to it.
Well, I have actually said, okay... So, I was interested in, when we spoke about it, that you said that if there's an idea, people have to put in the legwork. So is that more, like, you know...
It's more relevant to my experience of living in Banbury.
Yeah. And then I was interested in this idea of... I kind of made this into a metaphor in my head about the mind and body separation that happens in institutional settings.
Yeah.
So, like, in the CCA, you have, like, the people in the office who decide on the programme with their heads, and then you have the people on the ground that, like, clean the spaces, open the spaces, talk to the people who are performing, so they do all the physical work.
Yeah.
So there's this separation. So I guess I kind of wondered. I suppose that's what's behind this idea of a community driven space.
Okay, I'll do a little bit of a little description of my view of how that works. Then I think in the period of time that I've been associated with the barn as my case study. There's been a real, it's been a time of working that out, so it's been very interesting. It's quite a classic, it's relevant for this, there's quite a classic process that they're going through, which is the employment of people to deliver their aspirations, the aspirations of a group of people who began that community art centre out of a need, a social need, 20 years ago. And as things just naturally grow, as you know, that kind of drive to kind of being sociable, being active, that network grows, and So therefore then the organisational work to fulfil that wish and desire, it either spreads equally and evenly in shared responsibility or rotating responsibility, or it stays with a core group who decide to, you know, they want to shape and frame it, and there comes a point when it becomes too much for them, or they want to stop doing that, and that seems to be a really classic kind of cycle. So what then happened is, or happens, is that they gradually start to employ a bookkeeper and administrator, all those kind of functions and tasks, which is kind of manageable, but the barn hit a point where they decided to employ a director. And the there's been real very interesting challenge to both visions of the director that they appointed, and then the board in particular, you know, steer it, working out what it is that who they are as a community driven space in relation to that person's particular vision for the way that it should go forward and what she'd been employed to do. And eventually, after 2 years, they've had to kind of part company because it became clear to both, I would say, that actually they were pulling in different directions to each other. So, although probably a very painful experience for both, which I think it has been, I think when you go through those situations, you do emerge clearer about who you are or what you are, and that's where the barn is now in thinking around that. And I think what's very interesting about the way that they're doing that is that they're engaging more with a kind of a core group of people who are called volunteers, as well as staff who are there, in working out how to go forward. Yeah, again. So it's just a fascinating kind of cycle of reforming, reshaping, that's, you know, exhausts everybody, is emotionally absolutely draining, can damage an organisation publicly. So people are quite wary about doing it. So in that sense, they have driven, you know, they have kind of taken a hold of the situation in, you know, that they, a process that they began thinking that it would be about letting go, and have never felt they could let go in the way that they wanted to. And possibly the conflict is about the person that they employed to direct feeling, yeah, that they weren't letting go so that that person could get on with their vision, if you see what I mean. So there's a really, the reality of the situation is that there's a real kind of conflict within this, or a working out of what this actually means.
This community-driven space.
Yeah.
Conflict.
Actually, what does it mean? And that's what they're motivated to understand themselves.
I think,
you know,
I think that's quite interesting when I think about South Seas a little bit, because it has that same, like, or if I think more generally, then I think it's quite rare in some ways that the director, as it turns out, what's happened is that the director has gone instead of the community. It seems that the process is probably usually the other way around.
Do you mean at the barn?
No,
oh, it's
I mean, no, sorry, I meant if you look generally at institutional, the process of institutionalisation, that then you get a lot of these. There was a really interesting paper, which I should talk to you about as well, about at the conference about that, about like these big art centres and how they can't engage with the community setting that they're in at all. Like, and it was an interview between a researcher and an artist who has worked in the outreach department. And he described his kind of interactions with the community and how they were blocked by the art centre in various kind of ways that were not really direct, but just that there was an incompatibility somehow. But I'm going off on a tangent, I think. But that in this case, that the community hasn't fallen away from the...
I think it is relevant what you're saying, because it is about how does a bureaucracy or an institution... I know. How does sociability, going back to that, permeate between those two? How do they interact with each other? You know, how does a volunteer speak a sentence so that the director of the organisation hears it meaningfully? You know, a really interesting example that I'm hoping to interview him. Is Tom Finkelpearl, who's the chief exec of the Queen's Museum. Just looking on their website, and a thing apparently he does regularly, but you know, this might just be fantastic marketing, and I'm looking forward to seeing if he does, is that he goes down to the public space, the atrium, where they have a ping pong table, and he just plays ping pong with anybody that's walking through. Now, for me, that's a fantastic idea, so that he can find out what they're thinking, what they're interested in, anything about them, the place, feedback, da-da-da. Now, if he does really find time to do that on a regular basis. So I'm thinking that I'd like to interview him while I'm playing ping-pong with him, actually, would be the best thing. So in terms of sociability, I think he's got it. You know, it's just... I read it and I thought, ah, yeah, that's what hasn't happened at the barn, that sociability, and
with the director, and
finding a space or an activity where you meet on a person to person.
I think the space is a massively important element in this, or like creating the space, and that came up in their paper as well. That somehow, like because the building had cost so much and things, like it was threatened by the young, you know, like there was an actual real threat to its kind of pristineness of the young people that were in the community around it. And like, we had a ping pong table in CCA actually for one of
we had one at Wakehead.
An artist put it in for an exhibition, but funnily enough, like, nobody from the office ever played on the ping pong table, but the duty managers who do all the hosting and the gallery. We all played each other. So I guess it was interesting.
And is that in relation to your physicality, that you knew each other physically anyway from the work that you're doing,
but also
with your split
of
mind and body?
Well, we occupied quite literally the same space, whereas the offices on the first floor are never occupied. You know, the exhibition spaces, except when they were closed and then we didn't occupy them. So, you know, there was a complete divide in space.
Yeah. Well, I'm much more interested in, and this goes through APG, in the difference in time as opposed to space.
Yeah.
And I think that, yes, they're obviously related. You know, I'm not a physicist, but they obviously are related. But I think what Tom Finkelpearl is cracking there is the different time frames within we operate within an organisation. So my experience of that as the director of an arts organisation myself at Wakehead, when I was like in the office, that, you know, you're motoring at 100 miles an hour, you kind of, you've got all these deadlines, you know, and the conveyor belt of the next exhibition, and then you're working on the 1-3 advance of that or whatever. And because our context was studios, and I also had a studio, which I would be in like at least 2 days a week. And my friends had studios, and my partner's studio, etc., etc. I actually knew what time was like when you're in your studio. And as the director, when I was at work, Helen at work for 4 days, I would often take visitors in, or I would go through, because we used the same kitchen, and I would bump into people. And I literally know what it feels like to be working at a different speed to the people that I was meeting. So I would turn up, so go into someone's studio, and they were in like painting mode or contemplating something really deep about the difference between two colours, for instance, or being social in the kitchen, having just, you know, gossipy conversations or whatever, just being very social. But I've had like 2 minutes to get my cup of coffee and to get back because I'd got that paper to write. And it's really awful. I always felt really guilty that I wasn't respecting people, that it somehow turned them into people who paid rent to the organisation, which paid my salary or whatever. You know, it was like I wasn't socialising with them. I tried really hard to do that. I was very aware of it enough. But I think that if Tom Finkelpearl has found a way to enter, shift his time frame and space to hook into that time frame of somebody arriving at Queen's for the day as a tourist or whatever, out of his chief exec time frame and pressures, then he's doing a really good job. So I think that's really difficult to do. And I've, you know, when I think about this community driven, that difference between the employed people there and the non-employed people there, what are those differences really about? You know, what is the difference between doing that work because you've got a salary and the contractual arrangements and have you got a line manager, etc., to turning up because you're possibly in the luxurious position of not needing a salary and it is social. And you've got certain, and it fulfills certain needs in your life. The two really different reasons for being there, and they're still working at how people, because one of the issues that popped up is that the staff didn't feel valued by the volunteers and community members, and the community members and volunteers didn't feel valued by the staff. So how do you really bridge that gap, so that you are all working as part of a community-driven space? So I don't know if that's answered your question, but it feels really important. And what's happened at the barn is that the community have gone, actually, do you know what, this has been really awful and difficult, but it is ours and we are driving it. Yeah,
I think that's a really important thing there that is slightly different from whatever is happening in Queens with the tourists and Tom Finkelpearl.
Right.
And that is that somehow out of this process, there's a feeling of ownership over the community have said it is ours. And so, I mean, because what I was thinking is, like, in some ways the time thing is more amazing with Tom Finkelpearl, because in terms of programming and what are you going to get from the visitor, you know, the occasional visitor who doesn't have investment in the space, and whereas if you can find a different way to use your time in those collaborations, then they feed into the programming and all of that stuff in the space. So, like, but then somehow it seems to me quite hard to, like, create a commons, like a space that everyone feels that they have ownership over. I think I've always been interested in that, like, and that somehow the process at the barn has done that. So that's probably at the heart of what I mean, like, and that
the space.
Wooden Barn is owned by the community, have said. It's difficult, and you know, also that they've gone through a process and they've decided it's ours. So I suppose then to unpack that process is what we need. You know, you've done a lot of work speaking about in Lavender.
It comes to your question about the relationship between academia and the community organisation. What do you actually say? The crossover, the contribution, what contribution, I suppose, can academia make. Yeah, that's kind of what you're saying, isn't it? Between the crossover, to explore the crossover between community knowledge and academia, interrogating by context sensitive examples. Yeah. So, my experience then, if I'm getting that correctly, what you're thinking about is what role I think that this connected communities doctoral research has had in that process. Is that right? Is that kind of, is that useful? Not sure I'm on the right track.
No, yeah. First of all, I think what I had in my mind when I was writing was that we have the situation at South Seas where we're like an organisation formed by people in a community.
Yeah.
But then Govan Hill is a really complex... It's like the most overpopulated area in Europe. It has like a large kind of refugee it's got a large Roma community for starters. It has a lot of transient elements to it, people moving in and out that put high pressures on the services. You know, it has a local kind of Scottish representatives. It also has a big Asian community, like, you know, it's got mosques and so basically it's this big clash. It's got a lot of issues. It's got you can sort of see them, they kind of manifest themselves on the streets and stuff. Like, there's a lot of kind of rubbish dumped and antisocial behaviour, and, you know, there's a lot of conflict between, I guess, like, sort of, I don't know what to call them, indigenous Scottish people and Roma communities, as in the children on the streets, and then they have lots of meetings about how they talk about traffic calming and moving traffic bollards, and what they mean is they don't want the kids on the street. But they don't know how, you know, and then, you know, there's a lot of local Asian businesses, and then they have their own perspectives on it. Like, so what I'm saying is, like, when we formed South Seas, we were interested in, like, taking back community spaces from, like, these, from you know, that if they're conflicted spaces, and making them into spaces that everyone can feel part of in a more kind of, like, have this ownership. So that's why I'm so keen on this sort of idea of ownership, that if you feel that the space is yours, then you won't abuse it so much. Like, you know, that, you know, you abuse those spaces, like, you dump things in them, or you, like, because you don't feel like anyone's... acknowledges your right to be there, you know, anyway, so that we wanted to, like, do something in the local spaces, and so we decided on this guerrilla gardening thing, and then we had, like, a group of people who were quite interested in, like, climate change and things like that, and quite good at, like, finding out how to get money, and so, you know, it's gone from this space, this community of people in a larger, very different community with lots of differences, to, like, a little bit similar to how you described the barn, that what happens is as the network of the thing grows, then you need people to organise it. So in our case, it got money. So we got money for Climate Challenge, and then so we have to employ people. And then suddenly you have exactly the same thing. Then you have the staff and the board, who are the original community members.
Yeah.
And the staff don't feel that they understand what the board wants. Then there becomes this disconnect, because somehow the board, like you said, they have, like, more work or whatever, and they're less involved in the day-to-day stuff.
Yeah.
So the exact thing is, they're not the community anymore somehow. Like, they're extracted, you know, in this complicated way. And then, so when I was asked to, like, try and bring the board and the staff together, and I had been collaborating with you, so I decided, like, to use parts of your, you know, things that you said had worked for you at the barn, so to try and be more sociable, meet in a more sociable way and have a meal. You said there was the meal, but kind of
And
to try and read the bits, the moments between people where they were excited, and so the common, basically to try and get those common points again. And then I can't remember what I started talking. Yeah, so you have this cycle. So what I wanted to do was to try and figure out then, because I had moved away from the community into this academic context, like I wondered what, you know, because it's clear that, you know, what can happen if you're rooted in the community and you drive it forward physically and all those things, but then I wondered about this other, like, going away and reflective process, and so that's how...
Which is a specific situation into academia, because you could have gone away to a different situation, couldn't you?
Yeah, so I think I suppose I wanted to know what could be, you know, what you could bring from this other position that wasn't just like abstracting, like...
So it's like the research relationship with the community.
Yeah.
And in a way, what is for that not to just be like as a case study taking, in a sense, the learning without...
Yeah.
As a one-way traffic, in a way, it's a kind of one-way.
Yeah.
Which is the sort of classic, possibly social science or anthropological kind of image of it. I might be doing them a disservice there, but, you know, the idea, well, the, I don't think anybody holds it anymore, but the idea of a researcher collecting data, you know, with a kind of clipboard, kind of watching people. Well, actually, I do know of Connected Communities Project, which is really like social science based, and even uses art as its practice, but is completely different to the way that we approach it. You know, is much more kind of data driven in that sense. So I think even within arts practice research and Connected Communities, idea of research from the Arts and Humanities Research Council, there are differences within the way that people approach that, different methods and different relationships, I guess, then with the communities that they're working with. So I think if we're talking about academia here, what I've always thought was quite important to put some stress on is the fact that my relationship with Wood and Barn is part of a longer term relationship that Anne Douglas has with the place, and she is a board member as well, so, you know, I think that has to be acknowledged too. I think that's important. And I have no doubt whatsoever that we have played a part in my practice, but also her views, you know, as a member of this community, because she lives here, in supporting the community to actually say, actually, do you know what, this is ours. You know, so I think in the relationship between research or academia and that place, our particular perspective, it might not be another research community's perspective, but our particular perspective is that that is the more desirable outcome from our point of view, and have had an influence in that, I would say, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, so in terms of my work with Lavender, the things that I can sort of point to are things that participants have said, say at the closing conversation that you were at, for instance. The subject matter itself you know, their question of how can we be more sustainable, which is like at the heart of my original research question or research brief, is about them asking these questions, isn't it? It's kind of how can we sustain what we've begun in you know, and not just kind of keep it going, but actually thrive in a changing environment that's sort of changing economic and cultural or cultural economy. Words still out for me on which of those it is. And I guess I saw it as my role then was to find a way for them to think about that and discuss it, but also to experience that. And as you know, what I did was I spent a year being their artist in residence, building trust, building relationships, being known as an artist and a researcher, finding a position to operate from, all of those things, to the point where kind of a year in began this question of a more collaborative project across the organisation. So invited people that I saw sat within all those different categories, you know, directors, employees, volunteers, different associate groups, to come to a dinner, New Year's dinner, to I always did this in relation to the chairperson as well, who's also one of my supervisors. So you know, I've always had a kind of a process of I'm thinking of doing this. I've always got feedback on everything I've done, so it's never me just, well, not on everything, but on this anyway. Who do you, I think these people should be at the dinner, what do you think? And there were some differences, you know, so on the whole I would go with what feedback I would get because it is their organisation and I am the guest in it. But I question, you know, I question some of those decisions and I kind of reflect on some of them now as well and wonder what difference it would have made. And so this subject was shared and they came up with a subject that we thought we could talk about sustainability in a more specific way, which was the local production cultivation of the lavender, Banbury lavender. And that played out to her in a way that has two ways of looking at it, both through the sort of ecological aspect of the nature of lavender, which is highly adaptable as a plant in terms of sustainability, but also this kind of quirk of nature that that particular part of Deeside is a sort of Mediterranean microclimate, you know, weirdly, in Scotland, but it is, and it has like sandy soil and these long summer days for a short period, which lavender loves. and then the history of the Ingesetta company itself, and you know, the whole innovation of this person coming back from China as a chemist to have that desire to set up a business, and his wife as well as partner, and to have the skill and knowledge and tenacity, because you know they with their family had very lean years until it started to kick off in a more interesting way for them. And so that story just gathered momentum, and we worked on a collaborative exhibition together. It was quite a simple sort of format, really. But the managing of that from an institution outside of it as a researcher and as an artist is very interesting. In that, in terms of methodology, it's the whole issue about this sort of double ontology of both kind of being a participant and an observer, kind of influencing the research, influencing the life that you are researching. So in a sense, the sort of simple solution to that is to, as we do with this sociability, is to kind of write about that as well.
Yeah. You've got it's a bit of a... Mm-hmm. The double position is... This actually was a snag when I was writing the questions, because... I mean, you're double in terms of being an organiser and a participant, right? Is that what you just said? Or
no, an observer.
An observer and a participant, but also you're a researcher and an artist, so you're completely split.
Well, but it doesn't feel like that to me, obviously, but I think that it might explain my vision. This would be interesting. I sometimes feel like I don't have a... There's a blurring that happens between the shift between the two all the time, and I sometimes feel at a disadvantage in both situations, or at an advantage, I'm not sure. If you see what I mean. So it's a little bit like that example I gave you of being the director of an organisation and an artist in the studio, and knowing what it feels like to be both. I think there is an advantage to that. And possibly that's a leadership thing, which should be interesting to talk to John about, and thought about it like that before, because you're leading and shaping from that double knowledge of the two perspectives. But actually, you are then kind of neither one nor the other. So in terms of identity, it's a bit weird, confusing.
But I mean, just from the example, though, it produces insights.
Yeah, I think it does.
So I suppose that, in some ways, is reassuring, because when you look at it from the researcher, artist point of view, or the question of what the academic can bring to the community, I suppose.
Mm.
There's a question of insight from this other perspective.
It crosses over, it cuts many, many ways. So, you know, it's about familiarity and the unfamiliar as well, isn't it? There are some people there who are also artists, so I have an affinity and an understanding with them.
Mm.
There are some who are women, and so I have and who are my age and have children with my daughters, you know. And then there are a lot of people who don't fit into any of those categories that are brilliant to work with, and, you know, obviously really interesting to kind of learn from, you know, in whatever way that happens. So it cuts many ways. It's not just your... I think what I'm saying here is that there's possibly a third division, which is who you are as a person and your life experience. Isn't that? Because that informs you of the other two.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know. So, I've always got on well with one of the administrators because he's really into football. You know, which kind of had no interest in most other people in that place at all, but it was the way that we connected. Mm. And so that influenced sometimes maybe the priority he might give to something that I needed doing because we had a rapport or whatever. Or just find those connections with people. That was being social, and that's good.
But the
research. Well, keep me on track, Caroline.
Yeah. So just like I want to sum up, I'm gonna.
Okay.
I think that. That's why I've almost lost it. No, I think it's interesting, this whole thing where one person has three positions, at least, right? So your personal, one, and your observer one outside the situation.
That's
and
researcher.
Being involved one in the situation.
As an artist or dash professional.
As an artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was just thinking that that's just one person, and then if you bring into the equation, it becomes, like you said, if you're trying to write about sociability, like incredibly complex. Because if one person is already three people, then the motivations and intentions that cause action are so massive. Then I thought about Hannah Arendt, because she says that, you know, philosophies aren't willing to deal with the chaos of politics. Like, because you can't, it's totally unpredictable then. Like, you know, if you just took it on the mathematical, I'm not very good at maths, but the probabilities once you bring in so many different things are high.
Well, yeah, because sociability also isn't about affinity, is it? You know, it's about curiosity as well. I think it gets really complicated when, or really interesting, when the ways that we communicate, operate socially, are clearly influenced by our kind of life experiences that get us to that point. You know, they're very different. What is exciting, I think, about engaging with this, I think it's just acknowledging all of that is kind of all you can do, I don't know, and I think it's important to acknowledge it. But that it's the same for everybody, you know. So that it's like, where we've got to is like the starting point of how you then start to relate to people in an interconnected way over a period of time in a particular situation, which is an organisational structure owned by a community that's got this 20 years of history. And you talk about place, and you know, they made a massive decision to place the art centre at that farm outside of the town. Or is it outside of the town, rather than in the town hall, you know, on Bankery High Street? And they have a constant worry, I would say, about not relating to a large enough part of the Bankery community. You know, there's a constant worry about that. They're almost sort of incomers. You know, that's not actually true. But yeah, that continues, I think, that issue, that location.
Yeah. I think I told you I thought South Sea should be a bus instead of an office.
You did, yeah.
That it would always be, because it is in Govan Hill, but it's still, we still worry that the office is on the edge. You couldn't get quick enough, or like this. It's talking about like how the blackboard is so important.
In the office?
Outside the office, on the street, the street presence.
Oh, yeah, in the blackboard.
It's totally, it's kind of really weird to like think about these.
It is.
Crazy, I mean, because they're incredibly different. Like context that we're talking about,
I know.
But
yeah, very interesting.
Should I get back?
Yeah, where did we get to?
So, we talked about community-driven spaces.
Right. Yeah. Cultural mapping next.
Approaches. Are we on the? Right, artistic approaches to cultural mapping. So I've said that I think your work at Wood End Barn is cultural mapping to the extent that it's gathering a community around an organisation, a community-led organisation, by looking at its history and reading its interests from inside the community. So I think what I mean is that you went in to the community that's leading the organisation, and from that's where you grew the project.
Yeah.
Based on what, yeah. As you already described, so
yeah.
To get to this lavender story. So that's where I saw community mapping as forging community identities.
Is it community mapping or cultural?
Cultural mapping, sorry, cultural mapping.
Okay.
As forging a community identity through a metaphor.
Yeah.
That the artist arrives with.
Mm.
In the community, so.
But I didn't arrive with it.
No, arrives at with
okay.
the community.
Oh yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
I just said
yeah.
wrong.
Arrives at
rather
the
than the artist turning up with it.
Yeah.
Like it comes from
yeah.
being inside it and
Can
so
I, yeah. Okay.
Cultural mapping. That's
yeah,
how
talk about that.
I'm looking at cultural mapping.
Yeah.
Is that but then so I've got this kind of active idea of cultural mapping, I suppose, that you're not just like, when we said it before, you're not coming in with a clipboard and
mm.
writing down what the culture
mm.
is like, you know, as in like I tried to do with Govan Hill, where I said, well, there's this, where I could give numbers or whatever, but that it already exists before you get there,
mm.
but that it's a kind of active thing, because by the time you're done with it, it has
mm.
another identity based around this metaphor. So the way I saw it parallel was the community garden spaces that,
mm.
like,
mm.
you are, you know, working with what's there to make something that everybody decides that they want to make sort of together.
Mm-hmm.
But then by the time it's finished, then there's another identity that that group of people who made the space have. So,
yeah.
And
yeah.
cultural mapping is
mm.
a kind of active thing, but maybe mm. taking liberties.
I don't know. It's not a phrase I'm really familiar with, so that's quite interesting. So how do I see, how might cultural mapping describe the Lavender Project? Is that useful to think about that? Is that
is
in
it
relation
a form
to the
of
place?
Mapping
is
that
it a form?
Did
yeah, is it a form
this
of
Lavender Project, or is it not?
I don't warm to it as a phrase, I don't think. because it's like it feels a bit, what's the purpose of cultural mapping?
Yeah,
what is
which
it?
Is kind of like
what's
the
it informing?
Of the question, why
yeah.
do you do it? Like,
yeah, it sounds like it's instrumental for some bigger cartography or like census of society or something, you know, cultural mapping. Who owns the map?
Mm-hmm.
No, whose perspective is it from?
Well, and I'm trying to argue, yeah, I guess I think we do different things, like,
mm.
I think I tend to just, like, make words mean what I want them to, you tend to go, wait a minute, that word's not very good. And I go, well, it could be good if we saw it like this.
Well, how do we see it?
Just
from that. Sorry. Okay.
I want to see it like.
Tell me.
But like I said, as in, you know, from within, the community maps itself and.
Okay,
why
I
would
get
it
you.
Do
Sorry,
that?
I
and the reason it would do that is because it wants to survive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. I needed a clue there.
Like,
it's
I don't
fine.
Just. So that to me,
yeah.
that's.
Yeah.
Like, I realise that actually the other word, the way you were talking about it, is probably more how everyone understands it.
I don't know. I can relate to what you're saying,
mm.
I think. So. And I think. From recent conversations with participants in it, I think that some of the things they say resonate with what you're saying. For example, one person said that she thought that the Lavender Project was art because of the sort of the deeper insight she had to the lives of people in her community who she'd been living alongside for 25 years. And, you know, had never had any sense of that previously. So
mm.
there's that sort of revealing
yeah.
who you are in relation to who the others are in your community in a you know, which people seem to value. That's what they're saying, that they, that adds meaning.
I would say
to them,
it's massively valuable.
Yeah.
You take Coverdale and people don't have any way to relate to each other.
Yeah, so finding out what their histories are.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, like obviously in sociability, you say that there's curiosity for difference, but it seems to me that that's harder.
It's not just me being liberal, sort of.
I think it's more problematic, you know.
Yeah. Is there more fear?
Yeah. I think it's like you said, if you have things in common, then it's easier to talk to people. I don't know. But it's not only that, like, curiosity is there, but somehow then, I don't know.
I think we come at that from different positions, don't we? Not you and I, but people. And so it's totally understandable that for some people that curiosity might be there, but is almost impossible to activate, to speak the sentence.
Archive of what's already been done.
Well, people have responded well to the idea of archiving at the barn, and I think I shared with them the quote that you told me. It was about Francis McKee's quote around that we need our archives to survive, that they're essential to survival, to sort of know our past. It's really essential. And people at the barn responded really well to that idea. I think partly because they are in this period of transition, so maybe that's when people want to make sense of how they've arrived at where they are. So that's quite a good image in terms of mapping, isn't it? It's kind of can archive become a kind of making sense of the map, or the signposting to the future?
Yeah.
I'm sure that's part of it. And then how does an archive reflect, you know, all the great things we've learned about archiving from Susanna Waters at CCA, that a really good archive reflects the structure of the activity itself. It tells that story through its form. What does she mean by that? She means that you organise documents or artefacts in the way that they've been produced or been stored over time or found. And kind of, as you know, the kind of the missing parts of archives that have moved on. Are they referenced? Even if they're not there, that's quite an interesting one, I think. So can a map have an absence in it? This is a complete rhetoric, but I've got to share it now because I've had the idea. Andy's sister's boyfriend, Adam, was trying to convince us, and I need to get to the bottom of this, that on every Ordnance Survey map there is a mistake. I don't believe. but he says that He knows somebody that works Ordnance Survey map, and that they do this so that it's about copyright of the map. So there's something that somebody wouldn't, if it's reproduced, they can identify it as their map because it's got this idiosyncratic mistake. So we have this is totally off track. It's like, we had this great conversation about the sort of thing that might be appropriate as a mistake on a map, because, you know, it can be really serious in terms of the relationship of the archive material, the literal map, and people's lives when they are finding their way through the world. There's suddenly a hill that isn't there, or, you know, whatever. Or a footpath, you know, that's just been drawn in. So there's a kind of really interesting other way round of thinking about that. The archive going into the future, informing the way that people move into the future, rather than the way that we're thinking about it as we, this is the life and we're archiving it. It's really important to understand that's not the end of the story with a map or an archive. Yeah, because that's why you're doing it.
Yeah.
So there's an enormous philosophy, isn't there, around it.
Yeah.
I even like the way that I think Derrida writes for them. I mean, I don't know very much about him, but I think that he writes like a cartographer, in that, you know, he kind of takes an idea and then he looks all around it, like 360 degrees around it, and he's like in one sentence.
Yeah.
And I think that's very interesting. Kind of,
he's very placed.
Yeah. It took me a while to figure that out. So those two perspectives seem quite important, don't they? Whether we're talking about this from somebody finding their way into the future through revisiting the archive, or people who are thinking about archiving their present for the future. That seems really important somehow. But they are about life, aren't they, both? Yeah. They're generative. It's a generative act in that way. And I think the two things I know about archives, one is the one thing that you say about them is that they're, well, there's three. There's the thing that Susanna says about them reflecting the nature of what it is they're archiving. I think that's really important. So it's not just the content, but the form, and I understand that as an artist and as a writer. There's the other, which I think is your point, that the archive needs to tell the whole story to the best of your knowledge, so that people find their own way through it. A great example of that is, I think, the one that I talked to you about with Suzanne Lacey's piece, where she took a group of young women with a video camera into her archive and made a piece of work of them responding to things that were happening in the 60s, you know, like three generations before them.
Yeah.
I think that's a great idea. And then the other idea, what is it? Susanna's. You also had a third. Yeah, I can't remember it. big picture. Oh, yeah. It's that the archive, yeah. So when somebody's moved through it, they leave it as they found it. So there's no trace of their footsteps through it. It's very important with an archive. And there's a fourth then, because I've remembered that one. The fourth is that... Oh, it's gone again. This is elusive, this idea. Yeah, that the documents or the artifacts, the process of moving through an archive is that the one document reveals something about the other document, that it generates new knowledge all the time. And so it is that's what someone's doing when they're moving through. They're retelling, aren't they? They're retelling the story.
I must have read it when you started to get concerned, because I said the second part of hidden narratives is what is transferable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then I said, given that you arrive at the work being immersed in the context, so, like, that the context is so important to this kind of work,
yeah.
Then is anything transferable? So, and that's at the heart of the paper, as if we can extract strategies without reducing the work to, like, a toolkit for other projects. So, to me, that's pretty important.
Yeah.
And how... go about
oh, I remembered. Okay, so you've triggered one of the characteristics of Deserto, which is very important, and it's that it's adaptable, it's adaptability. That part of the agency of the tiny everyday action is the fact that people translate it, convert it, adapt it to their own circumstances. And so, I'm only happy to go with that set of characteristics because it's got that one.
So, in fact, it is.
I don't want a toolbox methodology or critical framework. It's not going to be a methodology, it's going to be a critical framework. Wait and see. We're having a right punch-up. But because it's got that, I thought, you know what, I can really live with this because I don't want anyone reading my thesis or my archive kind of going, this is how you do it, because that's not the way it works.
Okay.
These are a set of... I guess it is a critical framework, actually. She's absolutely right. Just answer the question. It's like Capro's loose framework for a happening. It's a path. You let art run its path and you create the conditions for that to happen. Okay, so you really got to get that across. This is not how you are a socially engaged artist or how you work with participants, and this is how I'm trying to get across to Fraser. And when we go to Utrecht, I think I'm really excited to sort of feel the difference between our papers and other people's, because I think there is a culture of the toolbox.
So how do you... Am I in danger of doing that with your work by trying to talk about it in relation to South?
Only if you don't take it as... only if you read it as you do this, this, this and this. Or if I write it so that... you read it in that if you do this, you will get this result. Because this is a very important point and it is at the heart of the paper.
Yeah.
You won't. Because it took me a year to get to that point in a particular journey. And you might. But you have to take it, you have to read it, and you have to understand it and digest it and reinterpret it in your own... for who you are and who, and what the context is and who those people are. That's the basic point. Is that clear?
You have to...
say that again.
Take it.
You have to understand it, digest it, synthesise it. Yeah, so it's quite, in terms of a pedagogy, it's a high level of, it's a meta level of learning in that it's synthesis. You take it in.
I like the way you said digest.
Okay, yes. You're eating. Are you getting hungry?
No, I'm going to be smarter. Are you getting hungry? No, just because so much, you know, like, there's the meal and there's the food.
Yeah, so you have to digest it.
I had something. I'm afraid it's gone.
Adaptability.
Oh, I just wanted to say about this framework. That there are interesting discussions, like Griselda Pollock is really angry about methodology, about the use of the word methodology, you know.
Right.
So I don't know if this fits in, because she says, you know, like, feminism is not, if you call it a method, you remove it from its political, you remove it from its political potency, potency's not the word. But yeah,
is it source? No.
So, you know, like, she sees it as a
Because I keep using the word agency and potency.
Agency are not the same.
No, they're different. And potency, I'm looking for a word that is about the potency of sociability, but the potency isn't right either. So, you know, it's what makes it active.
Yeah, so she says that this term methodology, and she kind of, like, writes about it quite a lot. Like, she gets annoyed at people who are calling feminism a methodology because it's not. It's related to political action. You can't extract.
Activist, yeah.
So this is kind of... And then Spivak, Gayatri Spivak, also says that she...
I thought you said Gayatri
Spivak. Gayatri.
Excellent.
She's getting there with me. Like, Gayatri Spivak. It's not what it... So, but the sense... instead she kind of, like, writes about strategy, which she thinks is okay because it's related to politics, and she has this whole other... Well, it's a similar, like, battle. It seems like lots of people are battling with different words around the same thing. Like, so you're battling about frameworks and toolkits and annas and...
I'm sure it is a critical framework.
Talking about strategies, that you can have strategies because they're still related to politics, but in each of these cases, or I don't know if it's the case for you, but in each of them they relate to politics, which is just basically the field of action, right?
So
like about making things possible.
So I think that's absolutely right, that this isn't a methodology. She's absolutely right. It's a, you know, loosely choreographed framework, you know, which I quite like that term. It is what Capro developed from Cage, you know, the non-art and the chance operations, you know, that workshop that I did. It's absolutely about creating the conditions for the sound from the street to be a part of the music that you're listening to.
Fran talked about chance operations yesterday. Oh, still. And she said that was funny because she used it in her manifesto statement.
Oh,
chance
right.
operations should be instituted as reason.
Yeah.
But then when she talked about it yesterday, the chance operations were kind of like, it turned out to be like a really rigid, awful thing. I was like, what?
Really?
I mean, it meant to, no, like the chance, by using chance operation, you realise that it's not, that it's got its own tyranny or something.
There is a real tension because, a happening has a strategy, you know, it is an intervention. But I think that it contains the possibility of chance operations, that's how I interpret it. And as soon as you're working with people, chance occurs. But obviously, I suppose if you take it really philosophical level, then, there are some things that you select. Selection occurs, doesn't it? I don't feel quite worried about that.
I always want to include everything.
but you don't know that you see everything.
Of course I do.
Arrogance. Of the academic.
So that's like...
So we got to the heart of the matter there, didn't we? Like the non-toolbox, non-methodology, activism, cultural framework.
Yeah.
Not telling people what to do or how to do it.
If you do this, you will not get the same result. So I've asked about pedagogy.
And I said it was synthesis.
How somehow the passing on of the work is important. Do you feel that way about your work?
Passing on of the work?
Yeah.
What do you mean by my work? The process that I... The conditions I create for these things to happen. I feel maybe it's a bit like Suzanne Lacy in a way. I think there is a legacy. I think you can just, you can do it in really different ways. The different, you know, if I think about that as an artist, I think you can do it through and they're probably interrelated, developing the language. So what I'm involved in at the moment is developing language from the with the participants to add their voices to the discussion, the discourse around the practice, which could influence both the way that it's taught, the way that it's critiqued, the way that it's valued, and the way that it's funded. Depending, you know, on where you take that information, that kind of knowledge.
So then I suppose the academic context.
That's the academic context. You could also decide to teach it practically within an institution, not as a toolbox. And I'm not quite sure why you'd do that, mind. I guess you can do it through being an artist and carrying on with the practice. And into that situation, you know, you can continue to be researcher. You can operate outside of academic institutions completely and work with apprentice artists or mentoring, or, you know, the participants that you're working with. You can influence the practices in many different ways. I think there's a big decision to make whether you're doing it visibly or invisibly as well, whether you know, the emphasis you place on.
Yeah, because I guess you get artists like Tanya Bruguera who are setting up school. So that's quite visible.
It's quite an understandable move. So how to move, I think, is such as UN's kind of thesis, isn't it? How to move. I think a lot of people are wondering about what their next move is and the best way to move.
Yeah, movement is the thing.
It is.
It's massively what everyone's talking about.
Women's society seems to be have changed, and we're all, like my friend and I were talking about this last night. It's like, I don't know, there seems to have been a moment where people have felt outside of what they thought they were inside suddenly, and now there's a moment. I'm sure it's the whole political thing of like we're in crisis and it's affecting you all, so there's a now kind of okay, so we're ready to get back into it now. So have we changed? Has it changed? How do we fit now? What do we, you know, how are we effective? And I think, if that's what you're talking about, it's movement.
It's just a recurring motif. Well, it's not just, it's all those real things, like, but...
But in relation to MAP, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking, UN talks about that. You have to create the possibility for movement. And then Marisha talks about how, if you're in a crack, what you want to do is find out how to move. Which she, you know, more... You know, she's a little bit more... as in to bring down the monument. And then there's in all the chat about the women's movement, which comes back now because of Lacey's, you know, like, because it's a lot about all the women remembering being in the women's movement.
Yeah.
I was speaking to, there was a Felicity Allen who was at the conference. She like was involved as a participant in the piece, and so she was kind of going through her memories of the women's movement. And she said, you know, when she was like 17, you know, she'd seen a blackboard outside a building on the street, and I kept thinking that sounds like blackboards. And that, you know, it said women's movement, come on in, and she had felt too frightened to go in.
Mm.
But she had sort of stopped outside it. It was just like a memory she had of that. But.
That's interesting. When I was at art school, there was a movement to set up in art history a feminist art history group, and I was one of the group of women who opposed that, but we wanted to take those topics into all the other groups, and the art historian wouldn't have it, and we all eventually got very bad marks.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a really political. But yeah,
we need to solve it.
And there was a group of women and a group of men who said, "Why? We don't want separation. We want those topics to be in the other seminar groups." But there were a group of women, including her, that were at that stage in their development, saying that there needed to be space for women to, you know, which I understand completely, and came to understand more later, actually, but. At that time in my life, I was 19, going on 20. I was just like, it's more important that these topics are discussed between everybody, rather than just, you know, and I feel very happy to do that. I'm not very respectful of women who didn't.